Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, jumping in to tell you about this week's episode of Meat and Three, Heritage Radio Network's weekly food roundup. This week, we're introducing you to some amazing women taking a stand.
So often, being sexually harassed feels like a loss of control. And so I wanted to have these very tangible guides to say, here's what you can do.
Others are pushing for more diversity at major food industry events.
I still feel really determined to do, you know, whatever I can to help shift that and in a direction that's not just more diverse, but more equitable.
We also have a report on that summer business staple, the lemonade stand.
The lemonade stand might be the purest form of starting a business. Low overhead, easy to get into, and requires little experience or special equipment.
Don't miss Meat and Three, your weekly 15-minute food news roundup from HRN. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Search MEAT plus sign THREE. And thanks, as always, for listening.
All right, welcome to the Main Course OG. I'm one of your hosts, Patrick Martins. You just listened to Rocket 88, credited as the first ever rock and roll song ever recorded. We are the first Heritage Radio Network show ever recorded, the Main Course. We were the first show to 200 episodes, and now we're back with the letters OG at the end of our names. So we are in studio here on May 31st with our point guard, Elizabeth Greeley.
Hello.
Emily Pearson.
Morning.
Mike Edison.
I took some Ambien right before I got here, so I can't be held responsible for anything I say.
Thanks, Roseanne. We have Ben Tanzel.
Hello.
And we are engineered by Vitor Hirsch. And tudo bem?
Bang.
And then our special guest, we're very honored that you would spend time with us, Lisa Held. And now I will throw it to Libby for the show agenda.
Sure. Thanks, Patrick. We have a great show planned today. We start with this segment, our weekly base, where we talk about current topics in the news and food industry. And panelists do not have the exact details of each topic and get to give their feedback. The next segment is Words to Marinate On, where we listen to an audio clip and discuss. The Mylard Reaction is the segment where I ask the panelists questions of the day and we discuss. And lastly, we have the Weekly Grill, where we ask our guest, Lisa Held, some hard-hitting questions. So we'll jump right in. The first segment is your Weekly Bake. There were two recent New York Times articles talking about the struggles of finding workers for restaurant jobs, including seasonal jobs. It's really relevant with the summer upon us. Part of the problem is a change in visa regulations by the Trump administration. Another problem is low-paying wages for teens and restaurant workers and just lack of teens in the workforce. Ultimately, some business owners are looking and not being able to open their stores due to these shortages. What do you see as a problem? Is this a restaurant industry problem, a seasonal job?
All right. Well, I mean, I'll start off. First of all, I think that people in the restaurant industry just need to be paid more. That's it. You know, all these also high-end restaurants are having trouble finding sous chefs because they're not paid enough. I mean, that's the big thing. You have to start with paying them enough and then go from there. And if that means your dishes have to cost a dollar more, so be it. The other thing I also think is, especially at these fast food industry ones, kids, they would have an easier time finding qualified people if we taught them how to cook versus how to push buttons. I mean, if they could come out of there with a craft, a skill that they learned, they would get more attractive people. Just pushing buttons, that's not attractive to anyone. I think basically the formula of fast food is off. Time has passed that by.
Well, I think you asked two questions. One is about immigration policy, and I think obviously if you could staff a restaurant with East European call girls, you wouldn't have a problem. Unfortunately, Mexican shift workers are presenting a massive problem for the racist in chief. And, you know, and that's it. It's just, unfortunately, it comes down to a racist immigration policy. But I agree with Patrick. People need to be paid fair, dignified wages, a living wage. It's ridiculous to try to get someone to work for less than that. These are hardworking cats and women. And that's it. And, yes, if it translates, you know, it drips down to the consumer, so be it. But anybody who runs a business has to pay their workers, period.
Although I do think you do have to look at who the workforce is that is available for these, you know, Libby referenced seasonal jobs as well. And I understand it's from the administration and there's visa policies, but at the end of the day, you know, we all want to visit these restaurants. We all want, you know, farm stands on the side of the road and things that are only in season. And I think we have to respect the people that are hardworking who do want to fill these jobs. If it's not Americans, it's not Americans.
And I think a lot of people want to fill the jobs if you learned how to cook, but that would be something that fast food is against. Where sure. Each single individual franchise location has charming inconsistencies because there's actually a chef there. They don't want that. They want everything to taste 100% the same. So that's it. They can't fill their, they can't open their stores.
Yeah, hopefully, we'll have a good summer when we visit and places will be open. We won't, but we'll see the effects of this.
Hopefully we won't go hungry.
Hopefully. It seems we are forever in a world of sales and acquisition, so it was interesting to read in Eater that Panera Bread's parent company is buying Pret-A-Mater, the grab-and-go UK-based sandwich chain. They also own Pete's Coffee and Krispy Kreme, among others. What would you say about fewer companies owning more of the industry, and will this style restaurant do well in the U.S.?
I think corporate conglomeration is like the American nightmare about to happen. It's not just the food industry, especially it's the communications industry where only a couple companies own all the radio stations, where very few companies own all the access to information. I think when you have that so few corporate entities controlling the flow of food, that's also going to be a great danger.
I think for me, first thing that comes to mind is airlines. You know, if one, these days we're down to, in the U.S., Delta, American, United, if one goes on strike, if one changes all of its policies as for they're going to create a new tax, you know, we're at their mercy. To me, it's pretty frightening, actually, to be in the hands of just large conglomerates.
There used to be very active antitrust laws in this country once upon a time. Mm-hmm. And you haven't seen that in years. I mean, it used to be, like in the movie business, that's why I believe the Hays Laws were created, right? Because the producers of the films couldn't also be the distributors of the films. Right? And you couldn't own the theaters. Now you have companies like ClearSpot and Live Nation that not only own the radio stations, they own the venues and the means of selling tickets. So who you hear and who you can see is very much decided by very few people.
Absolutely. I mean, I think literally half of all restaurants in the country need to close. A third or half. I mean, just literally, when I grew up in the 70s in New York, there might have been 1,000 restaurants in this town. Now there's 60 restaurants on every block. I mean, the amount of shitty commodity food that requires is just ridiculous. And also, I love France, where every block you go on, there's like a beautiful panini, you know, a baguette with ham on it, and it's just a higher quality product. Americans and all these Panera Breads is a concept. They come up with a concept and they find suffering animals to fill the meat in those sandwiches. It's just terrible. I mean, Ben, what do you think?
I agree with... it's sort of just difficult to say. Seeing that one chain is owning everything, it ultimately doesn't matter for the smaller people. Like Roberta's, for example, it's owned and operated internally. And it'll never suffer from a larger scale production. Mm-hmm. But when you look at something larger like a Dunkin' Donuts entity, yeah, their food is garbage, but we all know their food is garbage. And it doesn't matter who owns it, as long as the stock's trading high mm-hmm. and the people invested in there are all succeeding.
And what do you think makes that work? The concept? They just market a little better than the other big company that owns all the other stores?
Exactly. It's all comes down to marketing and who owns like whatever share. Mm-hmm. And it's all traded larger than we all know. But ultimately, yeah, we know their food's garbage and it's terrible for the environment, but we can't really fight that. But we can fight it on a smaller scale, going to the little guy that's privately owned, that knows that they're supporting, you know, the small farm and that they're buying heritage products and pushing that envelope.
That reminds me of what we said on week one, stay off the grid and you're okay. And that's not all the time, because I ate a bacon, egg, and cheese sandwich this morning and have no idea where the bacon came from.
From a very cruel system.
But, you know, the goal, slow turning of the wheel, is don't buy your food from corporations.
Very true. So we have touched upon alternative meats in our past shows. I'm sure it's something that will come up again in our next shows. But it's interesting to see a downward trend of milk. So sales of fluid milk fell 3.5% in the past 5 years, ending in 2017, while dairy alternatives grew 4% over the same time. The dairy industry brings in roughly $600 billion in global sales every year, while the dairy alternative industry accounts for just $18 billion. Some argue there is no evidence to prove dairy-free milk is healthier, but brands have done a better job of marketing it, and this saw from CNBC. So looking at this, where do you see the milk industry going? Do you see that is something that's, you know, trending down, or is this just a minor fluke?
I don't know if it's trending down. I don't think that the dairy alternatives are ever going to take over the, you know, true liquid dairy milk industry. But I do think that people are becoming more knowledgeable about their health. I don't know if you can say healthier or less healthy. I think to me it's in general, we all tend to overindulge in things, and I think that our bodies do react, and I see that, you know, the Oatleys and the I don't even know that. You know what? I don't drink dairy alternatives. But I will say that in our office, you know, we're only 8 people. And of the 8, 2 already in the last 6 months have become, you know, dairy-free or using dairy alternatives. So I do think that it is a current trend, but it's also about health. And I think people are respecting to have less of regular dairy and maybe to substitute with alternatives. I don't know what that says about the market, but...
Well, I mean, first of all, some people are sick and are legitimately lactose intolerant. So I'm not talking about those people. But anyone who says milk is unhealthy, I mean, I kind of want to, like, punch them in the gut. That is so ridiculous to me that you attack, you know, milk. Come on, like, that's off limits. You can't do it. You can still try to launch your industry, but don't pretend that milk, because that's fake news. That's going to confuse consumers, especially young consumers. That being said, if the milk industry is $600 billion and the whole alternative industry is $18 billion, then what is milk whining about? Like, I mean, that's $18 billion. That's nothing. And that they're like, oh, but we could be, we're only at 98% right now. We should be at 101. Those people I want to punch in the gut, because that is greed. That's saying that there's a little downward trend. I mean, you know, by the way, when we started the heritage turkey business with 800 birds, we got a lot of upset people in the commodity industry thinking that those 800 were going to become the trend. Also, the gun rights people, they say, oh, if you allow, make a little rule against guns, it's going to be a slippery slope. And it's like, no, it's not. It's not. Don't use that 3% or 0.03% as the world's falling apart and our stocks are going to plummet. But so anyway, that was a complicated answer, but I'm mad at everybody.
I agree. I think you're setting a very bad example for children. You know how you get milk, Patrick? You got to pull on the cows, you know, and almonds don't have. Therefore, how could it possibly be milk? Sorry, that's the Ambien talking.
Is that almond?
That's the Ambien
talking. Is that your almond? Yeah. I can't believe you have an almond sound effect.
When you squeeze an orange, you don't get orange milk, you get orange juice, right?
Yeah.
Okay?
Someone going to say orange juice is unhealthy? I mean, that has to stop.
You know, it's like that old joke, how do you get down from an elephant? You don't. You get down from a goose. You know what I'm saying? Okay. I mean, call the thing what it is.
Yeah.
That's all. And listen, if people don't want to drink cow milk, don't drink cow milk. But you're right. It's not a threat to the industry, which is so massive. I do think people, however, are getting fed up with big agriculture and getting a little worried about what's actually going into those cows and coming out of those cows. You know, you put in, you get out.
Oh, my God.
Well, I think that I would... go off of that, how are the animals being treated? Are you thinking about how the cows are being treated? But also another interesting, milk hasn't really changed its packaging, and then like almond milk and all this have bright cartons, new. Is it more advertising that's driving this? It's interesting. There's a lot of layers to it.
Yeah, it's also the production side, though. It's like, what does it actually cost environmentally to produce a gallon of milk versus a gallon of almond milk? Which... takes more water, which produces more mm-hmm. carbon, essentially, in the footprint of the product. And those are all, like, I guess, heavily weighted things. It's like, with dairy production, yes, there's a lot of, like, hay involved and a lot of water involved and a lot of methane produced. However, on the almond side, like, what, one almond takes, like, 8 gallons of water or something to produce? Insane mm-hmm. like that. So with all this, like, how many almonds does it actually take to make a gallon of almond milk or soy or hemp or whatever the lactose alternative is?
It's true. I mean, I always said that, but I was using the word punch in the gut because I'm not so smart, but the word Carlo Petrini used to tell me, the founder of Slow Food, which I always liked what he said. It's a good lesson. Let them take their path.
That is
let good. Them take their path. Let you take it. Don't be against fast food. Just take your own path. Because if you build Slow Food to be anti-fast food, then you're taking their path. Somehow you're on their path and you're discussing things in their terms. So I like that. Let the almond industry take their path. You take your path. But don't diss the other one as being cruel or, you know, that's where things get to be.
And as you said, it's still $600 billion versus $18 billion.
They're doing okay.
It's a nice sentiment. Take your own path.
Yeah, take your own path, dude.
Just be chill. Take your own path.
Is that a path? Path sound effect?
And we're very excited to have journalist Lisa Held here with us today.
Applause.
Thank you. She will be giving us a quick overview of an article she recently published in Civil Eats. So she will be taking over for the last segment we'll talk about.
So this is the first time we've had a guest person do your point guard job. All right.
Exactly. No pressure, Lisa.
I have so many things to say about milk, but I'm going to stick to the script and talk about my story. This was a story that ran on Civil Eats about a week ago, and basically it was about how small farmers and food companies can't afford lawyers. So there are these groups that are trying to change that and make legal services accessible, and they really feel that this is really essential for building the infrastructure of regional food economies. So the core group was the Pace Food Law Clinic, which is an initiative that was set up by Pace University and the NRDC. And basically, they're taking students to farms, and these students are meeting with farmers and helping them with the nitty-gritty issues that they encounter. Like, for instance, land access is a huge issue. So easements, leases, land transfers. So you need lawyers for that stuff, and a lot of farmers don't have them. And there's another group in New England called Legal Food Hub that's doing a very similar thing, but instead of with law students, they are taking practicing lawyers and connecting them with farmers who need help to work on pro bono projects. And then, so it's really helping farmers with the sort of small things that seem small, but that could be really big, could make or break their business day to day. But then also these groups are training lawyers to help them understand and interpret food laws so that they'll be able to help farmers in the future. One example, the Legal Food Hub people told me that they couldn't find one lawyer in New England who knew anything about the Food Safety Modernization Act, which is going to affect and is a huge, huge set of regulations that small farmers are going to have to deal with very little resources, and they really need lawyers for that. So that's the general gist.
Well, I would say it's really interesting. First of all, in the Bible, right, it says everyone has to give 10% tithe, or right, 10% mm-hmm. to charity. So all law firms should have 10% pro bono. I mean, that's a great rule. Big firms should be forced by the government to help certain people. Wait, yes,
you're advocating that big business is controlled by something that says in the Bible?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Do like Jesus would. That's one thing. And also, you know, when I was really poor and I couldn't go to the dentist, I tried to go to like a student dentist, you know, where it costs very little. And I think students who are basically lawyers, they're just maybe out in Bessel Bar, should absolutely 100% be forced to do 80% of their work. That's how you cut your teeth, is right, by going to help. So law, anyone who makes hundreds of millions of dollars over the course of their career should be either socially pressured or government pressured or by the law firm pressured to help people, because these people have no voice. And without a lawyer, you're screwed. One person gets sick, you don't have a lawyer, you go out of business, and it wasn't even your fault.
Well, I mean, legally, I have no idea what you're talking about. But morally, you know, I'm gonna turn away from the Bible and towards something called more like the Talmud, which is a little bit...
way off.
Again, it's the ambient speaking, clearly. But I think, I do think that we have a moral responsibility to help people who are less fortunate than us. I truly believe that. And lawyers are so expensive, you know? It's crazy. Anybody... can get sued, get nuisance suit, frivolous suit. You always need easements. No, God even knows what the paperwork for that looks like. Try to get out of a parking ticket. Yes, I do believe that not every lawyer should be like, ka-ching, ka-ching with the clock next to their phone. We do have to help people out, and I think helping farmers out is obviously very essential, but not just farmers. I mean, artists who can't afford lawyers need lawyers. You know, it's called doing the right thing, basically.
Yes. Yeah, no, I mean, if people are getting, lawyers need to do good and change that, perception.
I mean, ideally, again, this is the ambient speaking, lawyers got into the business to see justice done.
Mm-hmm. I also think it's great that, a journalist like you is exposing that these groups and these smaller institutions or smaller groups that want to help and do pro bono cases exist, because you're looking at New England, but perhaps in Missouri, maybe there's more of them, or maybe there's none. You know, who knows? But I think it is about just raising awareness and having resources. I mean, it would be wonderful if a university or someone had a database even of law firms or of students who haven't passed the bar yet, who are on a message board, or just somewhere where people can search for lawyers who want to help.
Yeah, I think it's interesting working with farmers and are they certified organic? And you're like, no, that's really expensive. They're working on that. It's not quite there. Too small of a farm. Just helping these people with all these little complicated things that the consumers want or that will help their business, but they can't quite do it on their own.
Ben, are you encountering needing legal services to start your liquor business? I mean, is that trouble for you or?
Perpetually, yes. Yeah. Dealing with a controlled substance is insanely wild.
So do you have enough money for a lawyer, for instance, or have you run into that
when
issue?
When it comes to having money for lawyers, I do not actually have those funds available to me. Our investors are more interested in it coming to market. And for us to come to market, there's a lot of litigious things that need to take place.
Yeah. But that's the cost of business. I mean, unfortunately, having a lawyer, legal fees is a line item in any business plan. I mean, it's just where it is. At any given time, I'm involved in multiple lawsuits.
Yes.
I find myself, on the wrong side of the table far too often.
That Ambien might get you sued today, huh? All right.
All right.
And then, by the way, do you have an opinion, Lisa, on...
Well, I just wanted to say, just in response to the fact that it's the cost of business, but I think that the interesting thing is, for these small producers, the industry is just really stacked against them. And so I think, thinking about ways that we can help support small producers in growing their business until they get to a point where they're able to...
Agreed. It's all stacked. The people with the deeper pockets are
right.
always going to win. And unfortunately, farmers and artists and other people who are at the margins of capitalism aren't going to be able to win a lot of these cases just because they don't have the money.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very true. It's sad.
Okay. Thank you, Lisa, for that. We're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsor. Take away, Vitor.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Okay. Okay, and we are back. You are listening to the Main Course OG on the Heritage Radio Network at Roberto's here in the heart of Bushwick, Brooklyn. We are moving on to Words to Marinate On, the segment where we listen to a short clip. Take away, Vitor.
We've been ABF forever, and part we try to control it through environment and feed. So Karen and I were talking about this on the way down. Like, we run 100% ABF program, but if an animal's sick, we treat it. I think it's inhumane not to treat an animal that's sick. But then we identify that, and we can market that pig in a different channel. But we don't give antibiotics for the purpose of growth promotion. But if a pig is sick or injured, then we treat it, just like you would treat your kids. You know, I mean, that's what they need. So in a year, though, I mean, our treatment rate here, we keep pretty stringent records of everything here. You'll notice, if you notice, all of our sows and boars have these little yellow tags. Those are radio frequency tags, so they're RFID. So we can actually use this little wand reader that we got every day when the guys take inventory. They use this wand reader, and it just collects all the data, and it pulls inventory. And then if something gets treated, they wand it, they record it, it uploads it. I mean, it's something that I tell people all the time, like, this is like no pig farm you'll ever go to, because it's like stepping back in time. But we use a lot of we use a very modern feeding system. We use a very modern animal health protocol. We treat for common diseases that anybody treats for.
That was David Newman, PhD scientist, meat scientist, and farmer of Newman Farms. It's got like the oldest Berkshire genetics in the world on his farm. I'll just start off that by saying antibiotics are fed to livestock because of bad genetics. That's it. It's the genetics. I don't know why that story doesn't come out more. I mean, I can't open the paper without reading a story about the gut health. Well, what about genetics? That is why antibiotics are in food, is because of bad genetics. So we have to improve the genetics of the industry. It's the simplest thing, and people don't say that. It's very unusual to find an article that talks about animals that grow so fast that their cardiovascular, respiratory, muscular systems just can't keep up with becoming obese, and they're obese because that's more profitable for big companies.
I like that he compares his pigs to children. No, I think that's good. And I think, again, maybe the ambient speaking here, but if I had kids, I would definitely give them radio frequency tags as well.
For me, I think it's, and being on Newman Farm, I was there on that trip where the clip came from. It really is a blend of the old world and the new world. And I think it's really important and special that he raises his pigs in a more traditional way. And his farm is open, and they're fully pasture raised. And each sow gets to pick her own hut to live in and raise her piglets. And yet that doesn't mean that they're just roaming wild and free, and they're not being tracked and well maintained, and as you said, geotagged every day. But to blend the modern technology and those benefits that the farmers can have with the old world, I think is really unique.
Didn't he say he wanted to have like hovercraft or something go in? What was that?
He said that he wanted to. He was looking into drones that would not startle his cattle. But I think that this way it would help with manpower. You still have to have enough people to be able to check on all your animals and to care for all of them. But it would almost be like a quick little bedtime check, like poking your head in to check on your child to see if they're sleeping. It would be sending the drone in just to make sure and see if anybody's missing.
I am actually amazed when I go to farms that we sell from. I am always amazed at how much time the animals actually spend alone. Like, it's a 15-minute drive to get to his cattle. So they're just these 30 cattle living alone most of the day. Like, what if something happened to one, you know? And Frank's turkeys, you know, he travels and they're alone for 15 hours. A raccoon or a fox could get into the, you know.
Bottom. Well, I think also, you know, something we learned from David and also from Frank Reese is that having, what's the name for the herding dogs, but that they're very helpful. They act as an additional employee on a farm. They're really important for being caring to the animals and also helping to keep an eye on things, to keep the coyotes out and just to maintain a healthy farm.
There are a bunch of breeds, the Maremma, the Komodo or something like that. These
the Komodo dragon.
Five or six breeds that just specialize in that.
A farm protected by dragons? So cool, dude. Have we discussed giving Ambien to pigs? And do you think their tweeting habits would change if we did?
I think it's interesting hearing from a farmer who, you know, doesn't... He's just being honest. He's like, yeah, I give antibiotics when they're sick. This is what you do. And instead of, like, hearing things from farms that, you know, factory farms or big companies that have something to gain, he's just, like, honest and giving you this information. He's like, yes, pigs need them when they get sick. I don't sell them, you know, to people who I tell I don't give them antibiotics to. But just being honest and understanding farming and how it works to, like, people like us who live in the city who don't get to visit farms all the time.
Touching off of that point, Liz, speaking with David Newman about this issue and him using antibiotics and how he sees it as an appropriate cause to treat a sick animal, on organic farms, they're not allowed to use, like, any antibiotics to maintain that level of their, you know, organic certification. So often when he visits these farms, he's seeing sicker animals because they're not able to treat them in any way. So that's almost like having a child and not giving it the right treatment, even though you know it's the right thing to do, but just to keep that pedigree of that stamp, they're not doing it.
Yeah. And then do consumers understand that?
Exactly. No, probably that's not. What it comes
down to. I'm supporting this good thing because it's organic. Mm-hmm. You never would think the animals were suffering.
It's deeper than that. Exactly.
The problem with antibiotics is when it's subtherapeutic, low doses in the feed because they presume they're going to get sick. That's the issue. And then the other thing is all farming, all animals, goats, every type of cow, was all the same from the settlement of domesticated agriculture, so 30,000 BC, all the way to 1960. And now 99% of the animals are a product of corporate agriculture, artificial insemination, overbreeding for certain traits. So the breeds we sell, heritage breeds, actually are connected to 5,000 years of agriculture. And all the commodity breeds are scientific experiments, basically, that are not working, and that's why they need medicine.
Exactly. All right. Well, that was great to hear from David Newman. Now we're moving on to the Mylard reaction segment of the show. So our question of the day.
What is the Mylard reaction, by the way?
That is when, Ben, would you like to go this?
The caramelization of proteins when you're cooking any type of steak or chop.
But
it's a desired trait then.
Absolutely.
But the reason I picked it was because it's when chemicals react and it creates flavor. So we're all talking and thinking and creating aroma marinade. I was getting low on food terms. Okay.
So what is the question of the day?
What is your one guilty diet chip or diet tip you have or one that you really dislike?
Just don't eat.
Bike rides, Budweiser, and pizza.
To lose weight?
Absolutely.
I'm still going with don't eat. I mean, that's not the healthy way. But if we're going with guilty, I think don't eat.
Or what's the worst diet tip?
My best diet tip to lose weight is only eat one thing. You could just eat potatoes. You could just eat apples. I mean, for like
this
breakfast.
This is not. Do not take this as scientific advice. Patrick, this will not make you lose weight.
You will lose weight. You look at me. I was. I was 380 before.
Diet,
now I'm down to 350.
Anyways.
Lisa, what's yours?
Mine is if you eat a ton of vegetables, you can drink as much as you want.
Oh.
That's great.
I just want to say, as an old Jew, I'm very familiar with the concept of guilt, okay? And I don't accept it, okay? I'm renouncing the guilty pleasure, the guilty tip, because I think feeling guilty about something is far more dangerous than anything you could possibly put in your mouth.
Wow. All right.
All right. Thank you, Mike.
All right, and the last segment of the day
is the Weekly Grill.
The Weekly Grill. So we are excited to have our guest Lisa Held with us today. Lisa is a New York City-based journalist who writes about the food system, sustainability, and health, especially all of the intricate ways in which those topics intersect. She's a regular contributor to Civil Eats and also writes for Eater, Edible Manhattan, Tasting Table, Food Tank, and other publications. She has a master's degree from Columbia University's School of Journalism, and we heard a summary of some of her work earlier in the show, so that was great. So thanks for coming on today, Lisa.
Thanks for having me.
Of course. So What is one thing that angers you the most about being a journalist who covers sustainability in the food system?
This is a really hard question because a lot of things make me very angry. I'm not even going to get into the agrochemical companies because we'll be here for hours. I think what I want to say really angers me often is when you cover healthy, sustainable food, there's often a perception that talking about these issues is elitist. Mm-hmm. So it obviously costs more and more labor, more time, more resources to produce food that's healthy and good for the planet. And there are lots of reasons cheap food is cheap. One of them is that a lot of the costs get passed on to consumers in ways that are invisible and people just don't know about. So, you know, the cost of polluting your drinking water, of making you sick later in life, of paying wages that are not livable. All those are real costs that are consumers don't see when they pay for just, you know, a burger at a store. And, you know, the companies don't want you to see those costs because they're getting really rich off of all of this. And that, to me, is an elitist issue. I'll just give one quick example. I don't have a lot of time, but there was a story that came out recently. So when Amazon took over Whole Foods, people got really excited that prices were dropping at Whole Foods. There's a ton of headlines like, oh, food is going to be cheaper. It's going to be great. You know, avocados were suddenly cheap. And everyone's like, yay. And, you know, then the New Food Economy did this awesome story where they talked about how Amazon is really good at taking advantage of corporate tax breaks and effectively last year paid zero federal taxes, and also is one of the biggest employers of low-wage workers who depend on SNAP benefits for their food. So while everybody's, like, celebrating that, they're making food cheaper, it's really cheap, and I can afford it now. You know, my avocado costs maybe 50 cents less, but my taxes are paying for Amazon to not pay their employees a living wage as the people at the top are billionaires. So that's sort of like a really, really simplified example. But there are a lot of contradictions like that that are hard to explain as a journalist and can start to make you sound like a conspiracy theorist a little bit. So, you know, I try.
You know, I said in the first episode, cheap meat. Who's arguing for cheap meat? That's at best classist.
Yeah.
And I even think it's a little racist, but I mean, it's at best classist. Cheap meat, you don't argue for that. You can't argue for that. It's terrible. And to accuse what we're doing as being wrong, right as we're trying to slowly turn the wheel towards a more positive direction, that's elitist. That's terrible. It's basically keeping the rich rich and the poor unhealthy.
Right.
Yeah, it's really, really tragic.
Right. It's like elitist to say, oh, well, you know, those people are poor. They don't deserve good food. No, I mean, like, healthy, good food is a human right, I think.
Absolutely.
I think this goes back to the issue of trust busting. You know, in a way, Amazon has far too much control over too many things that control our lives. Food, not only our entertainment and what we watch and what we read, and of course, at the way they're set up, it's impossible for a mom and pop shop to compete with them. I mean, mm-hmm. I love to go to a bookstore and pay full value because I love the people who run bookstores. They're heroes to me, honestly. That, you know, those people that keep those books on the shelves and support independent writers. But when you only have one channel like Amazon, and that's where you're getting your clothes, that's where you're getting your furniture from, you know, pretty much anything you can imagine, cattle feed, whatever it is, coming from Amazon, it's Jeff Bezos is running a slave farm. You know, and the part about him not paying taxes, well, either does the racist in chief, right? Remember that? You know, I don't pay taxes because I'm very smart. And that is the corporate culture. That's what we've been told. And I guarantee you, though, everybody in this room, when you go to see your accountant, you're trying to reduce your tax liability, mm-hmm. right? You don't want to pay 33% tax. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody here is an artist and gets a lot of 1099 income. You want to write off everything you can. Like my time with you, Patrick. I'm writing it off at a very high premium.
I written you off a long time ago.
But that is the culture.
Yeah, no, that was a great overview, Lisa, and a great example. I missed that article. We'll have to check it out. So what do you see as the future of reporting on food and sustainability?
Another small question. I've been really excited recently about how many stories are coming out that are really smart and deeply reported about the food system and the people producing food. There are lots of publications like Civil Eats, I'll give myself a pat on the back, but like the New Food Economy and Politico and NPR, The Salt, there's a lot of other examples I'm not naming, but that are doing really, really, really great reporting on these issues. But it's a lot of niche publications. And I think like what I would be great in the future, and I think this is starting to happen, is if mainstream news publications told these stories more often and put more resources into telling stories about food that are more than just dining reviews and should you add adaptogens to your smoothie? There's all these people that are interested in food from a dining perspective. And then there's this world of people that are interested in health and wellness. And those people often aren't basically, I don't know if they're not being told what's going on with the food that they eat or where it's coming from. Those stories aren't getting to them, but I think there's a really wide world of people that would care more if we told those stories in a more compelling way, and I hope that that will just continue to grow.
I can ask a question. I mean, who is your demographic that you're trying to reach? Is it students? I mean, how is that change going to happen so it's not so niche? Is it going to be taking a Super Bowl ad out, or how will that change? Who will be those? Is it principals at schools?
Well, I mean, I think from a journalist perspective, those audiences already exist and the publications already exist. Something like the New York Times has a huge platform and they already have those people that, like, again, like dining, and they do cover stories about farming and food production, but they could do more, and I think, I don't know about the audiences you mentioned. From a editorial perspective, I'm not exactly sure. I mean, local news for sure would be great if local news outlets were covering more of these issues. But, I mean, local news organizations just have very few resources and are just going away and being gutted, honestly. And
they're covering crime, local crime.
Yeah. I mean, they don't. They have one reporter being paid $25,000 a year. And, I mean, it's hard to get into some of this stuff.
That's interesting. As I look for articles every week for this show, you see, it's kind of like fluff. It's like, lose your belly fat or like, but eat healthier because of this. And it's like, but so like surface level.
Yeah.
But maybe as you were saying that, I was thinking maybe as people like things like paleo or ketogenic, and maybe that's an angle that we can get to them. Like, okay, this, or the whole 30, this is affecting me because of this. Okay, why? And then maybe they'll go deeper and deeper into, okay, how is it being farmed? How are they being treated? But no, it's so interesting. I agree with you. There's articles out there, but are they the right type?
And also, I always challenge my friends, read any article anywhere, and I guarantee you there's a food story somewhere behind the scenes there, and it's just not being covered through that lens. But if you wanted to, you could. That's kind of what Meat and Three is trying to do on this network, kind of what this show is trying to do with some of the articles we cover, but re-examining news through the lens of food.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so this question kind of changes it a little bit, but what stories will we be hearing about come election time?
I'm going to actually plug another one of my stories. Sorry. Sure. But actually just today, a story that I wrote went up on Civil Eats, and it was an interview with Marion Nessel. So for people who don't know who she is, she's an NYU professor who's really one of the most prolific commentators on food politics and food policy, and just really an incredible expert for decades. And one of the questions, so I talked to her about food, how food has changed over the past 30 years, where she sees it going. And one of the questions I asked her was about work she's done going over the Trump administration's food policies. So she was on a panel where she actually looked at every single policy that the administration has been involved in, from anti-hunger, anti-obesity, environmental, agricultural, so like anything that touches food. And so I said, what's the big takeaway from that panel? And her answer I'm paraphrasing, but it was something like, the answer is, it's all bad. There's just nothing good. And so that's a little scary, but, you know, so when we talk about the elections, you know, the elections this year will be the midterms, and I think a lot of people are saying that they'll sort of be a referendum on the first 2 years of the Trump administration. And so I think if you're coming in as a voter that cares about food and you're looking at what this administration has done when it comes to food, whether you care about the environmental side, getting healthier food to kids in schools, you know, helping farmers who are struggling, it's really just all bad news. So that's definitely a big topic that voters will be thinking about. And I mean, I don't even know if I want to touch the farm bill. It's
sort of, so complicated.
Well, I mean, the thing is, I want people to know more about it. I want people to think about it and care about it, because it's really, really impacts how and what we eat. But at this point, it's really hard to say what will even have happened, you know, what's going to happen next week with the farm bill, you know, let alone by the fall. So
I was going to say, do you think it will be, because isn't September the deadline? Do you think they'll have one passed by then, or
hard to say? Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, it's sort of every week it's like, oh, you know, we think it's going to pass this week, and, you know. Right, September's the deadline, so we just have to keep paying really close attention.
I think the question's really easy. It's just like clean water and clean air. When did having healthy children become a liberal issue?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And with, you know, the current moron in chief, I mean, basically, he's trying to destroy everything that came before him. He's obviously a friend of big industry. He's trying to destroy Michelle Obama's legacy.
Yeah.
You know, healthy children. I mean, look at the guy. You know, he's you know, obesely overweight. His own diet is basically one of poison.
Mm-hmm.
And this also speaks to what we were talking about before, about conglomeration, food conglomeration, media conglomeration, and it's not in the best interests of the news industry at large to report negative things about their brethren who they're probably, you know, smoking cigars with at, you know, the Davos summit. Honestly, it's the whole thing is run by a very few people, and it's not the job of local news necessarily to report national health issues. I mean, it is their job to read the crime blotter and report on local news, but so many of these stations are owned by large companies. They're owned by NBC, which is owned by somebody else, which is, you know, or ABC, which is owned by Disney, which is in Lord knows how many businesses. At the end of the day, if it's not good for Minute Maid, you're not going to probably hear it on the local news. It just trickles down that way. And I do believe that education is the answer, but it starts when kids are young.
Now, can I ask, as a journalist, are you now going to be, you know, really pushing to write all these articles to change people's minds and be anti-Trump? And then does that venture into what he calls fake news? I mean, are you now on a mission to overturn his policies or get voters to, or are your publications asking you to focus on those stories more? Or no, you guys keep doing the same.
No, I mean, I'm not, you know, my job isn't to be anti-Trump or to take a political stance. My job is to just tell people what is going on. And you know what? It's actually very easy to show people what's going on and have them make their own decisions. And, I think that will lead them to, when it comes to food, at least. I think most people, like you said, like, how could you be against healthier food in schools for kids?
Because I don't want you to tell me what I have to feed my children.
Right.
The ambience worn off, actually. That was me making sense.
But yeah, I mean, I can't take a stand either way. It's just about telling the stories and
telling the facts.
Yeah.
All right, well, thank you so much, Lisa. That was so interesting. We loved having you on today.
Thank you.
And thank you to our panelists. This is another great episode of the Main Course OG.
Stay tuned for Tech Bites.
Yes, 11 a.m.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.